Imagine the dry educational films you may remember from elementary school, showcasing the exotic practices of remote southwestern tribes as a vanishing culture. Now imagine these same films freshly interpreted by Native scholars who surface untold narratives and reframe the depiction as part of a living and vital tradition. The Tribe Sourcing Southwest Film Project is doing just this with the hundreds of educational and sponsored films in the University of Arizona archives.
Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like linguistics, technology, game and object design, and ethics. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
On this program, we're joined by Jennifer Jenkins, principal investigator with the Tribe Sourcing Southwest Film Project. Jennifer works at the intersection of literature, film, and archival curation in the American Southwest and Northern Mexico, with faculty appointments at the University of Arizona. We're also joined by project manager Melissa Dullman. Melissa is an AV archivist, researcher, and PhD candidate at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Both Jennifer and Melissa are members of the Tribe Sourcing Southwest Film Project team, which seeks to enhance, contextualize, and reinterpret mid-20th century archival films about Native peoples. Jennifer and Melissa, thank you so much for being with us today via digital remote from your various locations across the country.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for inviting us.
Before we get into some of the real nitty-gritty of what you're doing, could you each take a moment to sort of just explain what the Tribe Sourcing Southwest Film Project really is doing and what it's trying to achieve?
So this collection of films was donated to the University of Arizona in 2011, and it's about 460 films about tribes all across the Americas. And they came to us sort of in bulk as a digital humanities project. We had to figure out what to do with them. So they're wonderful visually. Most of them were shot on 16 millimeter Kodachrome. And they're from the age of the scholar adventurers, not exactly documentaries, but not exactly not. So the visuals are great, but the audio narrations are really products of their time. So to make this a useful educational resource, I had to start thinking about how to repurpose these films, not just to put them up on the web. That serves a function, but to think about how these might be useful from a 21st century perspective. So we came up with this notion of tribe sourcing, taking the films back into the communities where they were made and inviting members of the Native communities to respond to the films and comment on them and essentially re-narrate them.
The Mercadoo platform really facilitates our ability to share both outward and also incorporate their narrations. And so I really deal with more of the technological part of it, even though I have training as an archivist.
So Mercadoo was developed to work with Australian Aboriginal tribes. The name Mercadoo actually means a gathering place. And I think that's a really useful concept for people who aren't familiar with digital humanities projects and particularly decolonizing digital humanities projects. This is a digital gathering place for Indigenous peoples to access their images and gain sovereignty over them.
When we talk about the bad audio or narration, is this sort of the colorful exotic costumes and their pretty dances
and worse
narration.
And worse
or worse
and
okay what's an example of
stuff we're not supposed to say.
We can say we use one word, squaw, and that should tell you
everything you
need to know about where it can go.
Okay, so it's beyond just poor narration into just being completely racist, really.
Yes, for the most part they all fall into that category. They're trying to appeal to this kind of semi-racist, maybe not terribly evolved perspective of Native Americans anyway. So they're speaking to that audience and not really incorporating how you might actually speak to Native viewers.
Having watched a lot of your films, it seems like the original narration really frames it as an otherness, as an outsiderness, and lacks sort of the specificity of recognizing individual practices or whatever. So, you know, they do their exotic dances, but not here they are doing the buffalo dance. So what are your Native scholars adding? What does their layer look like?
I mean, I'll let Jennifer jump in, but it's certainly much more personal. It gives you actually the context that you need in any situation. It's corrective in many cases. And sometimes we don't know what they're responding to because it's in their native tongue. Only Diné speakers can understand it. So in some cases, I don't know what they're saying, and that's kind of a joy, to be honest.
I mean, we get really, really excited when we have no idea what they're talking about, because that's a real act of reclamation. Our job is not in any way to intervene or mediate that. You know, our job is to say, here are the films. What would you like to say about them to whichever audience you want to say it to? Do you want to say it to an outside audience, English speaking audience, or do you want to say it to an inside audience? Within the language. In many cases, these films will use a generic landscape or a specific landscape, but treat it generically. Every Native person in the entire Americas apparently lives in Monument Valley, right? But these films were shot in real places, and the Native narrators have the ability to identify places, particularly landforms in the background that have meaning to the people. And they can also often identify individuals by name, which is rarely done.
The whole part about identifying individuals and specific places, some of these films are probably 70, 80 years old. So who's doing that kind of identification? Is this someone who's very old now, but was a kid then? Or
it depends. The very first one we did that is sort of our proof of concept was shot on the Navajo Reservation, Pine Springs Trading Post. And that location was known. And then the narrator went and researched both orally and textually to find out about the white family that ran Pine Springs Trading Post and then the Native people who showed up in the film, and was able to do that just kind of by asking around about the Diné people, because we know the dates of most of the films to know who the trader was.
And on the landscapes, I just wanted to touch on that again, the generic landscapes. It's not that they reuse the same stock shot, but to the untrained eye, it's maybe desert, canyon, butte, whatever. But to the people that actually live there, it is our butte.
And it has a name, and it has a place in the cosmology or the cultural mythology. And I would just add that in the original narrations, the word desert is almost always preceded by the adjective barren.
In the unlivable American Southwest.
Exactly. Well, they're showing canyon country, which is gorgeous, but completely ignoring any kind of cultural identification with them.
Whereas even someone like me who moved to the American Southwest, The clay here is not the same as the clay 30 miles from here.
Exactly.
The original films you said were donated. Where were those donated from? I'm just curious.
It's one step earlier than that. So there was a professor at the Northern Illinois University at Normal. His name was Fred McDonald. He was a history professor. He did European, medieval, and Renaissance history. But he realized when film was going out of style that they needed to be collected. So he went around to schools and libraries that were junking their 16 millimeter collections and snapped them up, rented a warehouse in Chicago, and built this archive. And the Native material was not the only material that he collected. And so when he got ready to retire, then he put out a call for proposals for academic institutions to support his various parts of his collection, and the University of Arizona had a successful proposal for the native material.
I'm so glad he saved all that.
Isn't it? Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
How exciting to have a historian care about video.
I'm just so curious because I know that some people at other institutions like the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, the School of American Research, or even the National Museum of the American Indian, who have taken steps to actively involve Native people in interpretation of their artifacts, what they discover is not just that they get these valuable additional layers of specificity and information and often correction, you know, where some academic outside of that culture has come in and said, oh, I know what this is, and they're wrong, right? And the Native people say, well, actually. One of the things that I've found significant in these stories is that reconnection. I'm thinking of a group of Zuni elders who was brought in to interpret a collection of pots at the School of American Research. And some of the pots and some of the designs were ones that they had heard about but never seen because it was part of a practice or a style that had been discontinued. So it was a chance for them to reconnect very deeply and intimately with maybe an otherwise lost part of their heritage.
I felt like Krista Lutobin, who counter-narrates the Navajo silversmith, and because she both has been a student of that craft, but also is teaching that craft. I thought her watching somebody from the past work through that process with maybe more or less the same tools, but I'm not sure, but really having her sort of be able to reflect on what's happening in the screen, even in more detail than what the narrator is going into, is pretty interesting. That was a really valuable one.
Yeah, in the early days of this project, we went out to the Tohono O'odham Reservation west of Tucson, and those are our nearest Native neighbors, and showed a couple of the films that were shot out there. And it was a really emotional experience. It was not a very successful recording session because everybody talked at once, but in terms of reconnection, it was amazing. And it was really very emotional. These were folks in their 60s and 70s, seeing either themselves as kids or their siblings who were no longer with us, and sometimes their aunties and grandmas. And it also veered very quickly into O'odham language conversation. So I don't know everything they said, and we didn't really successfully record it. But I think that will be true with most of the films when they go back to their home communities, that folks will see people they know about or recognize.
So is it common that in a lot of cases, these communities have not ever seen these films? The films were shot and produced and then distributed, however, back in the day, but it's not like they went back and said, let's do a movie showing.
No. It wasn't collaborative, I would say, in most cases.
These were distributed by educational film distributors to, you know, mainstream Anglo K-12 institutions.
One example, it may have been Navajo, 1951. That one, I found some documentation where it had shown up in a local newspaper, like the Navajo Times. When it came out, they were writing about a little bit in the newspaper. Under sort of the film section, you can rent this film or it can be lent from a library to your school. I have a newspapers.com account and I sometimes look to see where they may have written about them.
They were filmed with the Native people as subjects of the film, but the Native people weren't involved in producing any of the content or the narration. So with this additional layer of post facto annotation, are some of the assumptions that went into those original narrations being questioned? I mean, some of the assumptions about who Native people are, or what kind of role they play in our society?
Oh, heavens, yes. It's so interesting to me, and Melissa, jump in here at any point, when we hear anecdotal accounts of people watching these films, a lot of times they're laughing because the narration is just so preposterous. They have plenty to say about what's really there, but they just find it incredibly ridiculous that that was the public face of whatever aspect of their culture that people were consuming.
There was, in fact, one film. It's called The Navajo Demon, or the alternate title, The Navajo Witch. And two different narrators wanted to tackle it. Wonderful. You know, like, what the heck is going on in this? So there's one where they're like, this is not done, or that's ridiculous.
Before we wrap up this segment, I did want to ask, when these films are getting re-narrated, reinterpreted, where actually are they now? I mean, you're not printing out 16 millimeter and sending it to K through 12 schools.
It's on a website called tribesourcingfilm.com. It's open access. Aspects of some of the films are controlled by the cultural groups that are represented in them, but people can get to it just by going to that website, which Melissa built.
We can go into it later, but each community can decide which films people are accessible to the public and which ones aren't. And thus far, there was one that had been screened to the public, you know, went, made the rounds of schools, maybe even on television. And then we scanned it and we put it up there. It really took the Navajo community to say, no one should have been seen. Certainly not a woman. A woman should not have seen this. This is really, really for medicine men in this tribe. And so that one's locked down. And then for any tribal member who wants that particular login, we can create a login for them. But that's one where they said, yeah, that should never have been made.
Especially if it's film of ritual content. Boy, does time fly. What a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much, Melissa and Jennifer. If you would like more information about this attempt to reinterpret and re-narrate mid-20th century films from the American Southwest and northern Mexico of Native peoples, you can visit the Tribe Sourcing Southwest Film Project online at tribesourcingfilm.com. You have been listening to Augmented Humanity, which is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUN FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.